tune out of the anti-white system
and tune into the pro-white system on RadioAryan.com.
Alright, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to our continuing series on Henry Ford's The International Jew. This is part 22. I am your host, Ted Midward. This is Caucasian Christian Communications. You are listening to RadioAryan.com. If you weren't able to catch the last show last week, I want to refer you to a YouTube channel, Gustav Johansson. He posts all these shows along with other pro-white, white nationalist, alt-right content. Alt-right Andy, I think, is one of his alter channels, and if it's run by different people, that's another good one to subscribe to. If you're catching this on YouTube and you don't tune in to RadioAryan.com, you're really missing out. There's a lot of great content over there. I suggest you check it out. If you like other historical stuff, kind of conspiracy history, I'd say I lean more that way. You can check out my content at tedmidward.info. And let me just say, this will be going out on the 19th, the 18th or 19th, I believe. Anyways, we're in mid to late December here, and I would like to say Merry Christmas in case you guys... And don't get another episode until then. I think it's so important. Everywhere you go, going to work, out with friends and family, this whole month, say Merry Christmas. Call up a couple synagogues. Tell them Merry Christmas. Be sure you record the phone call, too, and then post it on the internet so we can all enjoy it. Okay, so let's get started on this week's installment. The first article on our first segment here is titled... Why the Jews Dislike the Morgenthau Report. It seems a far cry from the Jewish question in the U.S. to the same question in Poland, but inasmuch as the Jews of the U.S. are constantly referring to Poland for propaganda purposes, inasmuch as there are 250,000 Polish Jews arriving in the United States on a schedule made by their brethren here, and inasmuch as the people of Poland have had their own illuminating experience with the world program of the Jews, it would seem that Poland has something to teach the United States in this respect. Especially is this true since it is impossible to pick up an American newspaper without finding traces of Jewish anti-Polish propaganda, a propaganda which is designed to take our eyes away from the thing that is transpiring at the port of New York. If a reader of these articles should say, "Let us not think about Poland, let us think about the United States," the answer is that he is already thinking about Poland the way the Jews of the United States want him to think, and the fact that he is thinking according to Jewish wishes in this respect incapacitates him up to a certain point to understand the entire Jewish question in this country. Three chapters back in this series, we presented part of a hearing before the United States Senate Committee on the census question as it affected the Jew. The immigration question appeared as part of that inquiry. Then followed an article which showed that Jewish authorities adopt principles exactly opposite to those which had been defended before the United States senators. A third article followed showing how Jewish leaders resent the influence of the modern state upon Judaism. All these subjects are essential to a well-rounded understanding of the Jewish question as a whole in its relation to the United States. Today we go back to the home of that quarter of a million people who are rapidly being landed on our shores to see what they did there, and to find the basis for Jewish propaganda statements that these people are fleeing from quote-unquote persecution. We have five official witnesses whose observations have been printed under the seals of the United States and the British governments. The American document is a, quote, Message from the President of the United States, transmitting pursuant to a state resolution of October 28, 1919, a communication from the Secretary of State, submitting a report by the Honorable Henry Morgenthau on the work of the mission of the United States to Poland. End quote. It is Senate Document Number 177. This document includes a supplementary report signed by Brigadier General Edgar Jadwin, United States Army. There's a certain mystery about this document. Though an edition was printed for public circulation, it soon became extremely rare. It seemed to disappear almost overnight. The copy from which this present examination is made was secured with the utmost difficulty. The head of that American mission, which remained in Poland from July 13th to September 13th, 1919, was Henry Morgenthau, an American Jew who had been United States Minister to Turkey, a man of excellent public and private reputation. It's commonly said that the Jews did not like his report, hence its scarcity. This much appears. The Jewish press has never made much of it. It is not cited in Jewish propaganda. It has not had the endorsement of American Jewry. The reason appears to be this, that it told the calm truth about the situation of the Jews in Poland and made very fair observations. But it is indirectly that the American Jews show the opinion which they hold of the Morgenthau report. And it comes about in this way. When the American mission left Poland, the British mission arrived and remained until December. The chief member of the British mission was an English Jew, Sir Stuart Samuel, whose brother Herbert is now High Commissioner of Palestine. He was accompanied by a British military officer, Captain P. Wright, who also submitted a supplementary report. The two reports were submitted with an introductory report by Sir H. Rumbold, British representative at Warsaw. Now, of all five reports, the Morgenthau, Samuel, Jadwin, Wright, and Rumbold reports, the Jews of the United States have circulated only one of them, the Samuel report. It's been printed in full in newspapers at advertising rates. It has been circulated broadcast as an American Jewish Congress bulletin. Any number of Samuel reports may be obtained, but none of the report which a member of the American Diplomatic Service made and which the President of the United States transmitted as a message to the Senate. Why? Because four reports examined the situation all around and reported it without bias, and if they were printed in the United States and spread broadcast before the people, it would throw an entirely different light on the Jewish propaganda in favor of Polish immigration in enormous numbers. Even when the Jews of the United States published the Samuel Report, they did not publish the Captain Wright Report which accompanied it. In the American Jewish Congress Bulletin, the Wright Report was condensed, mutilated, and shorn of its real meaning. While in the Maccabean, the reports of Rumbold and Wright are treated without courtesy, and the Samuel Report is published in full. That the reader may form his own conclusions, the testimony of the five official witnesses, or six of them if we count Homer H. Johnson, who signed the American report with General Jadwin, will be given on the principal points. The agreements and disagreements will therefore be noticeable. Number one, the first point, on the general subject of poisecution. That would be persecution for you Goyim. Sir Stuart Samuel says, "Poles generally are of a generous nature, and if the present incitements of the press were repressed by a strong official hand, Jews would be able to live, as they have done for the past 800 years, on good terms with their fellow citizens in Poland." Note how easily here Sir Stuart talks about the repression of the press. The Polish press has at last obtained freedom of writing. It is exercising a privilege which the Jewish press of Poland always had. But now that it speaks freely of Jews, repress it with a strong hand, says Sir Stuart. He would not dare suggest that in England, where the press is also finding its freedom. As to the Yiddish press in Poland, the reader will find some information in Israel Friedlander's essay entitled The Problem of Polish Jewry. Friedlander was a Jew, and his book was published by a Jewish house in Cincinnati. He says this, quote, "The Yiddish press sprang up and became a powerful, civilizing agency among the Jews of Poland. The extent of its influence may be gathered from the fact, which, curiously enough, is pointed out reproachfully by the Poles, that the leading Yiddish newspaper of Warsaw commanded but a few years ago a larger circulation than that of all the Polish newspapers combined." End quote. In that same document, Henry Morgenthau, in paragraph 7, says this, quote, "The soldiers had been inflamed by the charge that the Jews were Bolsheviks. While at Lemberg, it was associated with the idea that the Jews were making common cause with the Ukrainians. These excesses were, therefore, political as well as anti-Semitic in character." And again, in paragraph 8, it says this, "Just as the Jews would resent being condemned as a race for the action of a few of their co-religionists, it would be correspondingly unfair to condemn the Polish nation as a whole for the violence committed by uncontrolled troops or local mobs. These excesses were apparently not premeditated, for if they had been part of a preconceived plan, the number of victims would have run into the thousands instead of amounting to about 280. It is believed that these excesses were the result of widespread anti-Semitic prejudice aggravated by the belief that the Jewish inhabitants were politically hostile to the Polish state." End quote. Sir H. Rumbold says this, "It is giving the Jews very little real assistance to single out, as is sometimes done, for reprobation and protest, the country where they have perhaps suffered least." Captain P. Wright says this, "It is an explanation often given of what may be called, according to the point of view, the idiosyncrasies or defects of the Jews that have been an oppressed and persecuted people. This is an idea so charitable and humane that I should like to think it not only of the Jews, but of every other people. It has every merit as a theory, except that of being true. When one thinks of what happened to the other racial, religious, and linguistic minorities of Europe in modern times, the Jews appear not as the most persecuted, but as the most favored people of Europe." End quote. Brigadier General Jadwin states clearly that the Poisecution cry may be regarded as propaganda. He says this, quote, "The disorders of November 21st to the 23rd in Lemberg became, just like the excesses in Lithuania, a weapon of foreign anti-Polish propaganda. The press bureau of the Central Powers, in whose interest it lay to discredit the Polish Republic before the world, permitted the publication of articles, in which an eyewitness estimated that the number of victims, between 2,500 and 3,000, although the extreme number furnished by the local Jewish committee was about 76. And again, he goes on to say this, "In common with all free governments of the world, Poland is faced with the danger of the political and international propaganda to which the war has given rise. The coloring, the invention, the suppression of news, the subordination of newspapers by many different methods, the poisoning by secret influences of the instruments affecting public opinion. In short, all the methods of malevolent propaganda are a menace from which Poland is a notable sufferer." Of course, all this propaganda has been Jewish. The methods described are typically Jewish. Speaking about the number killed, Mr. Morgenthau estimates the total at 258, while Sir H. Rumbold says only 18 were killed in Poland proper, the others having been killed in the disorders of the war zone. Sir Stuart Samuel estimates the total killed at 348. Number 2, on the general cause of Jewish trouble before the war. Sir Stuart Samuel says this, "The Jews in Poland and Galatia number about 3 million. Public opinion had been aroused against them by the institution of a virulent boycott. This boycott dates from shortly after the by-election for the Duma, which took place in Warsaw in 1912. Business relations between Poland and Russia were very considerable in the past, and were generally in the hands of the Jews, not only in the handling of the goods exported, but also in their manufacture. Initiative in business matters is almost entirely the prerogative of the Jewish population. Nearly the whole of the estate agents who act for the Polish nobility are of the Jewish race. Attention must be paid to the fact that Jews form the middle class almost in its entirety, above are the peasants. Their relations with the peasants are not unsatisfactory. The young peasants cannot read the newspapers and are therefore but slightly contaminated by anti-Semitism until they enter the army. I was informed that it is not at all unusual for Polish peasants to avail themselves of the arbitrament of the Jewish rabbi's courts." Interesting. End quote. Back to the text here. This shows the Jews to have occupied a very favorable position in Poland, and is to be remembered in connection with the previous quotation from Sir Stuart, in which he says that if the incitements of the press were repressed by a strong official hand, the Jews would be able to live as they have done for the past 800 years on good terms with their fellow citizens in Poland. Let's take the points made by Sir Stuart and observe what other witnesses say about them. How about this point? Beginning with the point as to the Jews' monopoly of business. Sir H. Rumbold says this, "Sir Stuart Samuel would appear to be mistaken in his appreciation of the part played by the Jews in the pre-war business relations between Poland and Russia, and in the industry of the former country. Whereas it is true that goods exported from Poland were, to a large extent, handled by the Jews, only a small percentage of those goods were actually manufactured by them." Captain P. Wright comments, "In Poland, until the last generation, all businessmen were Jews. The Poles were peasants or landowners, and left commerce to the Jews. Even now, certainly much more than half, and perhaps as much as three-quarters, of businessmen are Jews. For both town and country, I think it's a true generalization to say that the East Jews are hardly ever producers, but nearly always the middlemen. Economically, the Jews appear at the very outset as dealers, not as producers, nor even as artisans, and chiefly dealers in money. In course of time, the whole business and commerce of Poland became theirs, and they did nothing else." That was about point A, which was the Jews' monopoly of business in Poland. We're moving on to the next point, point B, which is with regard to the estate agents mentioned by Sir Stuart Samuel. Captain P. Wright says this, "Poland is an agricultural country, but the East Jews, unlike the West Jews, play a large part in its country life. Every estate in every village has its Jew, who holds a sort of hereditary position in them. He markets the produce of the peasants and makes their purchases for them in town. Every Polish landowner or noble had his own Jew, who did all his business for him, managed the commercial part of his estate, and found him money. Besides this, nearly all the population of nearly all the small country towns is Jewish, corn and leather dealers, storekeepers and peddlers, and such like." Moving on to point C, regarding Sir Stuart's assertion that Jews form the middle class almost to its entirety, with the nobles above them and the peasants beneath them. This is a typically Jewish position, dividing Gentile society and standing between the parts. This illustration may help to make it clear. Captain P. Wright says this: "It is instructive to try and imagine what England would be like under the same conditions. Arriving in London, a stranger would find every second or third person a Jew, almost all the poorer quarters and slums Jewish, and thousands of synagogues. Arriving at Newbury, he would find practically the whole town Jewish, and nearly every printed inscription in Hebrew characters. Penetrating into Berkshire, he would find the only storekeeper in most small villages as a Jew, and small market towns mostly composed of Jewish hovels. Going on to Birmingham, he would find all the factories owned by Jews, and two shops out of three with Jewish names." Captain Wright, here, is trying to give the people at home a picture of the conditions in order that they may understand how Poland feels. The Jewish press strongly resented this. Sir Stuart Samuel's report is notable for the number of things he mentioned and the few that he actually explained. Okay, that's the end of the general point number two. Let's move on to number three. On the general cause of trouble arising during the war. Sir Stuart Samuel said this: "The fact of their language being akin to German often led to their being employed during the German occupation in preference to other Poles. This circumstance caused the Jews to be accused of having bad business relations with the Germans. The government publicly declared its disapproval of boycotting, but under a certain discrimination seems to have been made in the re-employment of those who served under the German occupation. I find that many Jews who thus served have been relieved of their offices and not reinstated, whereas I can find no evidence of similar procedure in regard to other Poles." Sir H. Rumbold commented with this: "The fact of Yiddish being akin to German may have been the reason why the Germans employed a large number of Jews during their occupation of Poland, although a great many of the Poles with good knowledge of German could have been found. There is this difference, however, that the Poles only served the Germans by compulsion, as they considered them to be their enemies." Brigadier General Edgar Jadwin said this: "During the German occupation of Poland, the Germanic character of the Yiddish vernacular and the readiness of certain Jewish elements to enter into relations with the winning side induced the enemy to employ Jews as agents for various purposes and to grant the Jewish population not only exceptional protection, but also the promise of autonomy. It is alleged that the Jews were active in speculation in foodstuffs, which was encouraged by the armies of occupation with a view to facilitating export to Germany and Austria. That is, the Jews were the means by which Poland was to be drained of its food supply." Captain P. Wright comments with this: "But the high day in triumph of the Jews was during the German occupation. The Jews in Poland are deeply Germanized, and German carries you over Poland because Jews are everywhere. So the Germans found everywhere people who knew their language and could work for them. It was with Jews that the Germans set up their organization to squeeze and drain Poland, Poles and Jews included, of everything it had. It was in concert with Jews that German officials and officers toward the end carried on business all over the country. In every department and region, they were the instruments of the Germans, and poor Jews grew rich and lordly as the servants of their masters. But though Germanized, the accusation of the Poles that the Jews are devoted to Germany is unfounded. They have no more loyalty to Germany, the home of anti-Semitism, than to Poland. The East Jews are Jews and only Jews." It has seemed certain that one of two, the German or the Russian Empire, must win, and that the Jews, who had their money on both, were safe, but the despised Poland came in first. Even now the Jews can hardly believe in its resurrection, and one of them told me it still seemed to him a dream. Mr. Morgenthau does not touch this matter in his report. That's the end of the third point. Let's move on to the fourth, which is this. with reference to the boycott, the method by which the Poles sought to liberate themselves from the Jewish stranglehold. Sir Stuart Samuel says this, "This boycott dates from shortly after the by-election for the Duma, which took place in Warsaw in 1912. During the war, owing to the scarcity of almost everything, the boycott diminished, but with the armistice, it revived much of its original intensity. A severe, private, social, and commercial boycott of Jews, however, exists among the people generally, largely fostered by the Polish press." In Lemberg, I found that there was a so-called social court presided over by Mr. Przyłowski, a former Austrian vice president of the Court of Appeals, which goes so far as to summons persons having trade relations with Jews to give an explanation of their conduct. Below will be found a typical cutting from a Polish newspaper, giving the name of a Polish countess who sold property to Jews. This was surrounded by a mourning border, such as is usual in Poland in making announcements of death. Here is that excerpt from the newspaper. "Countess Anna Jablonowska, resident in Galicia, has sold her two houses, Sriska Street, numbers 18 and 20, to the Jews Dogaluski, Hubner, and Erbsen. The attorney of the countess was Dr. Zidzik, her administrator, Dr. Naskowski. Will the Polish public forever remain indifferent and passive in such cases?" That's the end of the excerpt. Back to the text. This illustration of Sir Stuart brings to mind a practice common in England. It is related on page 123 of The Conquering Jew by John Foster Fraser, published in 1916, quote, "The housing question in the Whitechapel district has reached such a pitch that there are large blocks of buildings where 'no English need apply' is a common legend. Whole streets are being bought up by Hebrew syndicates, whose first act is to serve notice on all Gentile tenants," end quote. It's also worth stating, in this connection, that some of the feeling which has recently led to race riots in American cities has been engendered by the practice of small Jewish real estate syndicates purchasing a house in the middle of a desirable block, ousting the tenants, and installing a Negro family, thereby using race prejudice to depreciate the property in the entire block and render it purchasable by the Jews at a low price. Thereafter, the property is lost to Gentile ownership or use." Well, it's a pretty good strategy, I must say. It may be that in Poland, a similar condition exists, which makes the sale of property into Jewish hands a kind of disloyalty to the people generally speaking. Apparently, the Poles think so. Racial prejudice, quote-unquote, is not a sufficient explanation of such beliefs. There's always something pretty tangible beneath them. Boy, that's true. Absolutely true. The boycott, quote-unquote, was merely this: an agreement among Poles to trade with Poles. The Jews were numerous, they were well-to-do, and they were in control of all the channels of business. They owned practically all the real estate in Warsaw. The Jews claimed that the so-called boycott, the Polish name for it is the cooperatives, was persecution. Let me read that again because there's a line in brackets that I interrupted with. The Jews claimed that the so-called boycott was all about persecution. Folks, you know and I know, people don't hate Negroes just because they have dark skin. People don't hate Jews just because they wear yarmulkes and spin dreidels in December and believe some kooky, stupid, religious gobbledygook. People hate other people because of behaviors and what they do. Pretty simple. Sir H. Rumbold said this, It must be further remembered that under the influence of economic changes and owing to the fact that since 1832 the Poles have not been allowed to hold posts in the government, they were gradually obliged to take to trade. And competition between the Jewish population and the Poles commenced. This competition became stronger when the Russian government allowed cooperative and agricultural societies to be started in Poland. The cooperative movement is becoming very strong and will undoubtedly form an important factor in the development of economic relations in Poland, so that indirectly it will be bound to affect the position of the small Jewish trader. Insofar as the Polish government are able to do so by legislation or by proclamations, the boycotting of the Jews should be prohibited. But I would point out that it is beyond the power of any government to force its subjects to deal with persons with whom they do not wish to deal. Interesting. Henry Morgenthau, however, takes a more reasonable view than his British co-religionist Sir Stuart Samuel. Mr. Morgenthau says this: "Furthermore, the establishment of cooperative stores is claimed by many Jewish traders to be a form of discrimination. It would seem, however, that this movement is a legitimate effort to restrict the activities and therefore the profits of the middleman. Unfortunately, when these stores were introduced into Poland, they were advertised as a means of eliminating the Jewish trader. The Jews have, therefore, been caused to feel that the establishment of cooperatives is an attack upon themselves. While the establishment and the maintenance of cooperatives may have been influenced by anti-Semitic sentiment, this is a form of economic activity which any community is perfectly entitled to pursue." That's the end of Morgenthau's excerpt here. Back to the main text. "It's not difficult, therefore, to see through the eyes and minds of these five men the situation that prevailed in Poland. 800 years ago, Poland opened her gates to the persecuted Jews in all Europe. They flocked there and enjoyed complete freedom. They were even allowed to form a state within a state, governing themselves in all Jewish matters and doing business with the Polish government only through their own chosen spokesmen and representatives. The Polish people were their friends, evincing neither religious nor racial antipathy to them. Then Europe fell upon Poland, divided her asunder, until in the roster of the nations there was no more Poland, except in the hearts of the Polish people. During this period of Poland's humiliation, the Jews grew to be a mighty power, ruling the Poles, regulating their very lives. The Great War came with its promise of liberation and the restoration of a Polish free government. The Jews were not favorable to that restoration. They were not Poland's friends. The Poles resented this, and at the signing of the armistice, when they were free to express their resentment, they did so. Many regrettable things occurred, but they were not unintelligible. They had explanatory backgrounds. Even the armistice was not the end. The Bolsheviks from Russia came down upon Poland, and once more, so the Poles strongly declare, the Jews were against the land that had sheltered them for 800 years. These are a few of the facts. Another article will be required to complete the story. In the meantime, enough has been said to show the utter wrong which Jewish propaganda in the U.S. has done to Poland. But the purpose was not altogether to injure Poland. It was also to blind the American people and cause them to view with equanimity the great influx of those same Jews into this country." That's the end of our first part. This was published, of course, in the Dearborn Independent, October 30th, 1920. Well, you know what? A lot of people like to rag on the Poles, and I'll tell you what, it's incredible there is still a Polish people after the hellish 20th century that they had, and they're probably some of the best Europeans. It's going to be up to Poland and even Viktor Orban's Hungary, the Eastern Europeans at large, that are going to end up saving Europe if that's to be accomplished, if that's even possible. at this moment. So hats off to Poland. We sure love you guys. All the best. Okay, let's move on to the second article, the second half of today's program. This is entitled, Jews Use the Peace Conference to Bind Poland. This, of course, the peace conference is the Versailles Peace Conference, the Versailles conference that took place after the war where the Jews got together and Ben Friedman was there, if you know that story, and he comments quite a bit. Also, I'll just throw this out because this comes to mind, Ho Chi Minh, the George Washington of Vietnam, is at the Versailles Peace Conference. And, of course, he's ignored by President Woodrow Wilson and the Jews at large. And Poland has problems, but Vietnam has problems, too. And the Jews ignore him and don't give him any love or respect or attention. Interesting, don't you think? Okay, so the Versailles Peace Conference, you guys can go look it up. It's pretty much a bunch of Jew oligarchs and their bag boys. And Woodrow Wilson being there, and of course he's one of their bag boys, slicing up Europe and trying to backstab European countries and to roundaboutly push Bolshevism and give aid to, Germany almost went Bolshevik. It was very close. Luckily, praise Christ, they didn't. Okay, enough with the commentary. Let's jump right into the text. There is one difference between the Polish report of Sir Stuart Samuel and those of the others, which illustrates a difference between the Jewish mind and the general mind. The type of mind represented by the other investigators, Captain Wright, Brigadier General Jadwin, Sir H. Rumbold, and even Henry Morgenthau, is the type of mind which looks behind events for causes. Here is, for illustration, trouble between the Jews and other people. It is a continuous situation. There's always trouble between the two. We seldom hear of it, however, until the Jew begins to get the worst of it. As long as the Jew remains on top, making the Gentile serve the Jewish plan, there is no publicity whatsoever. The Gentiles may complain as much as they like, they may protest, and they may rebel. No international commissions arrive to investigate the matter. Trouble between the Jews and other people is designated as trouble only when it begins to grow inconvenient for the Jew. It is then that he sends the cry of persecution around the earth, though the plain fact may be that he is only being nipped at his own game. The Poles saw how the Jews clung together in the most admirable teamwork, a minority absolutely controlling the majority because the minority formed a close corporation, and the majority did not. So the Poles said, "We'll take a leaf out of the Jews' own book. They work cooperatively among themselves. We, therefore, will work cooperatively among ourselves." Which they did, and at once the cry of persecution resounded loud and long. Propaganda was begun against the good name of the Poles. More resentment followed. Regrettable violence ensued, and the dispute still continues. Jewish reports of these disturbances rarely go beyond the fact that Jews are suffering from certain acts of the Polish populace. Incident after incident is given with full detail, and with a very apparent journalistic appreciation of horror. Names, dates, places, circumstances are all in order. Very well. It is no part of this article to deny or minimize the suffering of the Jews, wherever or for whatever cause it may occur. There's nothing whatever to be said in the extenuation of injustice inflicted upon the humblest human being. The murder of even one person, the terrorizing of even one family, is a very terrible thing to contemplate. It is a great pity that the world has become so accustomed to the piled-up tales of horror that it no longer has any sensibilities left to feel the shame and degradation of these things. From the days of Belgium onward, all races in Europe have suffered, and by sympathy all races in America have suffered with them, though it is a fact that we hear more, far more, about the sufferings of the Jews than of any other people. Well, That's certainly true even 100 years, approximately, after this is written. There is, however, this reaction of the practical mind. Why do these things occur? Grant that robberies, assaults, and murders described in the complaint have occurred, why should they occur? Are the Polish people naturally given to perpetrating such acts? Have such acts marked the residence of the Jews in Poland for the last 800 years? And if the Polish people are not naturally abusive, if the story of the Jews' residence in Poland has been mostly pleasant, what causes these changes now? That's the way the practical mind works. It seeks to know the background. Mr. Morgenthau, apparently, put in too much of this background, though at that he put in very much less than the other investigators, except for Mr. Samuel. Therefore, Mr. Morgenthau's report was pigeonholed by American Jewry, because the facts make very poor material for the kind of propaganda which American Jewish leaders had in mind. Apparently, they did not dare publicly to criticize or renounce his report. They simply passed it over. Captain Wright, who endeavored to put in all the background he could find to make Polish conditions comprehensible to the British people, has been handled insultingly by the Jewish press. They don't want investigation. They want sympathy for themselves and denunciation for the Poles. In America, we're inclined to believe that every condition is explainable. It may be reprehensible, but it is intelligible. We believe that the explanation is the first step towards the remedy. Mr. Morgenthau does not speak of pogroms at all. In this, he sets an example that certain hysterical American Jews ought to follow. The present series of articles in the Dearborn Independent is a pogrom. Some Jewish spokesmen speak as if each separate article were a pogrom. The present series of articles in the Dearborn Independent is a pogrom in the hectic but uninstructive oratory of Hebrew Lodge meetings. But Mr. Morgenthau exercises more precision in the use of words. He says this, "The mission has purposely avoided the use of the word pogrom, as the word is applied to everything from petty outrages to premeditated and carefully organized massacres." On one point, all the reports agree, namely that the unjust killing of Jews has been on a scale so much smaller than that alleged by the propagandists that there is no comparison. In that part of Poland, where war disorder was less common, 18 persons were unjustly deprived of their lives. For the whole territory during the entire period when it was being overrun by various elements, Sir Stuart Samuel admits, apparently with reluctance, that he can count only 348 victims. Captain Wright says, "I estimate that not more than 200 or 300 have been unjustly killed. One would be too many, but taking these casualties as a standard with which to measure the excesses committed against them, I am more astonished at their smallness than their greatness." Sir H. Rumbold says this, "If the excesses had been encouraged or organized by the civil and military authorities, the number of victims would probably have been much greater." That the reader may see how the various reports run with reference to specific charges of brutality, the agreements and the divergences are set down. Look at the reports concerning what happened at Lemberg. Number 1. The excesses occurred November 21st through the 23rd, 1918. The city was taken by Ukrainian troops, formerly in the Austrian service. Number 2. General Monsuski raised in a Polish army, about 1,500 in number, consisting of men, women, boys, some of them criminals, and after a severe struggle, succeeded in capturing half the city, the other half of which remained in the occupation of the Ukrainians. A few hundred Polish boys, combined with numerous volunteers of doubtful character, recaptured about half the city and held it until the arrival of Polish reinforcements on November 21st. When the German troops revolted all over Poland at the time of the armistice, the whole edifice of German organization fell to the ground in a day. A few Polish officers raised a small volunteer force in Lemberg, numbering between 1,000 and 2,000, which was composed of boys, roughs and criminals, and even women in uniform. For nearly a fortnight, they fought in the streets against the Ukrainians and on the arrival of a similar force. They drove the Ukrainians out of town. This was really a splendid feat of arms. Number 3. The Jewish part of the population of Lemberg declared itself to be neutral. The Jewish population declared themselves to be neutral, but the fact that the Jewish quarter lay within the section occupied by the Ukrainians, and that the Jews had organized their own militia, and further, the rumor that some of the Jewish population had fired upon the soldiery, stimulated among the Polish volunteers an anti-Semitic bias that readily communicated itself to the relieving troops. During the struggle, the Jews proclaimed themselves neutral, but though I do not think they gave any armed assistance to the Ukrainians, their neutrality was highly benevolent to the Ukrainians and probably helpful. They thought the Ukrainians would win. Number 4. In the result, none of the military commanders responsible for these events has been punished. As early as December 24th, 1918, the Polish government, through the Ministry of Justice, began a strict investigation of the events of November 21st and 23rd. In spite of the crowded dockets by the local courts, there were over 7,000 cases now pending. 164 persons, 10 of them being Jews, had been tried for complicity in the November disorders, and numerous similar cases await disposal. 44 persons are under sentences ranging from 10 days to 18 months. Aside from the civil courts, the local court martial has sentenced military persons to confinement for as long as 3 years for lawlessness during the period in question. Speaking of the general subject of punishment, Captain Wright says this: "The government has inflicted a good deal, though an insufficient amount of punishment. These punishments, it has never been published for fear of Polish public opinion." And Brigadier General Jadwin of the United States Mission says, "If complaints as to slowness and uncertainty of military and government punishments and relief were heard, as they were, it seemed nevertheless to indicate that orderly process of government was in operation." Number 5. No compensation has been paid for the damage done. This mission is advised that on the basis of official investigations, the government has begun the payment of claims for damages resulting from these events. Payments had begun to be made in Wilna, Pinsk, and Lemberg before our departure from Poland. The occurrences in Lemberg were bad enough, to be sure, but Sir Stuart Samuel let it be understood that all the blame rested with the Poles. The other investigators gave reports that explained the matter, although no report could excuse it. And all but Samuel agreed that the Polish government did what it could to repair what had occurred and to prevent recurrences. This from the American report is worth considering. Quote, "General Jadwin was present at the taking of Minsk and a personal witness of the strenuous efforts of the military authorities toward preventing acts of violence. The fact seems to be that as soon as any sort of order could be brought out of the chaos of war, the disorder ceased. And yet we read, even today in our newspapers, of thousands and tens of thousands of Jews being slaughtered in Poland." Further, to indicate that these events did not occur without Jewish provocation to a certain extent, there is the case in Minsk. This was on April 5, 1919. Number 1. Pinsk had been recaptured from the Bolsheviki a short time before. The population was overwhelmingly Jewish, only 25% of them being Polish. The Polish officer had only a very small detachment of men, and the Bolshevist lines were quite close. The Polish officer was treated with coldness by the Jews, and he suspected them of friendly relations with the Bolsheviks. He was very anxious. he had posted notices that any unauthorized meeting would be punishable by death. The government organizer, this is number two, the government organizer of cooperative societies had given permission for the Jewish cooperatives to meet for discussion of the plan to join other cooperatives. Number three, it seems that two Polish soldiers and another soldier informed the military authorities that they had information the Jews intended to hold a Bolshevik meeting on Saturday in what is known as the People's House, being the headquarters of the Zionists. This meeting took place in the offices of the Zionist organization, which is very anti-Polish. It is recognized that information of Bolshevik activities in Pinsk had been received by two Jewish soldiers. The town commander, with judgment unbalanced by fear of the Bolshevik uprising of which he had been forewarned by two Jewish soldier informers. After the meeting had ended and been formally closed, a great many members of the cooperative association remained in the same room talking together. Other members of the Zionist organization, including ladies, were in the room at the same time. This collection of people must have presented the appearance of a meeting, and I think the members remaining in one room were numerous enough, technically, to constitute a meeting. There was some insolence in this, and the previous behavior of the Jews. Sir Stuart Samuel pointed out to the witnesses that their authorized meeting itself had been a breach of the Sabbath, and therefore a grave religious offense. All of the investigators agree in denouncing what followed. Captain Wright says the Polish officer would hardly have acted with such promptitude if the prisoners had been others than Jews. General Jadwin sums it up like this. The Pinsk outrage was purely a military affair. The town commander, with judgment unbalanced by fear of a Bolshevik uprising, of which he had been forewarned by two Jewish soldier informers, sought to terrorize the Jewish population. By the execution of 35 Jewish citizens without investigation or trial, by imprisoning and beating others, and by wholesale threats against all Jews. No share in this action can be attributed to any military official higher up, to any of the Polish civil officials, nor to the few Poles resident in that district of White Russia. Sir Stuart says this, "Under the present local administration, Pinsk is once more peaceful, and the relations between the Christian and non-Christian inhabitants have become normal." It's sometimes forgotten here in the U.S. that, for Poland, the war is not yet over. Poland is now a free nation, on paper, but her freedom seems to be a day-by-day tenure, dependent on fighting. Bolshevism has made serious inroads on her. Wherever the Bolshevik Red Armies swept across Poland, the Jews met them with welcomes. This is no longer denied, even in the U.S., it is explained by the statement that the Bolsheviks are more friendly to the Jews than are the Poles. A statement which readers of our recent articles on the Jewish character of Sovietism can well understand. When the Poles beat back the Reds, they commonly found that the Jews had already set up Sovietism, as if they had long awaited it and were well prepared. It's scarcely strange, therefore, that the Poles still retain their suspicions. The Jews do not want to become Poles. That is the root of the present difficulty between the two peoples. Sir Stuart Samuel barely touches on it. On several occasions, the resentment of the soldiery and civil population was aroused by the Zionist claim to Jewish nationality as opposed to Polish nationality. Mr. Morgenthau goes a step further, saying this. This had led to a conflict with the nationalist declarations of some of the Jewish organizations, which desire to establish a cultural autonomy financially supported by the state. Mr. Morgenthau, you will observe, gives a wider peep into conditions. But the best description of the situation is given in the report of Captain Wright, where he says this, "There," being the Jews, "their party program in Poland is to have all Jews on a separate register. The Jews thus registered are to elect a representative body of Jews. with extensive powers of legislation and taxation. For example, it could tax for purposes of emigration. This body had to be handed over by the Polish state a proportionate amount of money to spend on Jewish charitable and financial institutions. Besides this separate organization, a number of seats proportionate to their numbers to be set aside in every local and in the national legislature, a sixth or seventh of the Polish Diet to be occupied only by Jews, to be elected only by Jews. Some Jews also demand separate law courts, or at least the right to use Yiddish as well as Polish in legal proceedings. This is the practical program, but the ambition of the advanced section is national personal autonomy, granted in the Ukraine by one of the ephemeral governments of the Ukraine, the Ukrainian Central Rada, on January 9, 1918, and called the Statute of National Personal Autonomy, of which I have a copy. It organizes Jews as a nation with full sovereign powers. The Ukrainian banknotes were printed in Yiddish, as well as in Ukrainian. People sometimes ask, where is proof of the program of the protocols? It's everywhere the Jewish leaders have attained power, and everywhere they are striving for power. The protocols can be written out of Jewish rabbinical writings. They can be written out of Jewish tendencies in the U.S. They can be written out of Jewish demands in the Balkans. They can be written out of Jewish achievements in Russia. They represent the Jewish program, ideal and real, at every stage of modern history. Do you ever hear of this Jewish program in Poland when you are invited to sympathize with a quarter million Jews who are being brought from Poland to the United States? Will these people leave their ideas outside New York Harbor? I think not. Incidentally, Captain Wright's full investigation of the Jewish program may throw some light on the refusal of the American Jews to circulate his report, although it was attached to the report of Sir Stuart Samuel, which is being so widely circulated. However, that his government at home might fully understand the situation, Captain Wright draws an illustrative parallel, saying this: if the Jews in England, after multiplying their numbers by 20 or 30, demanded that the Jewish Board of Guardians should have extensive powers, including the right to tax for purposes of emigration, and that a separate number of seats should be set aside in the London County Council, the Manchester Town Council, the House of Commons, and the House of Lords, to be occupied only by Jews chosen by Jews, that the president of the Board of Education should hand over yearly to the Jews sums proportionate to their numbers, if some were to demand the right to have separate Jewish law courts, or at least to be allowed to use Yiddish as well as English in the King's Bench and Chancery Division, if the most advanced even looked forward to a time when the Bank of England notes were to be printed in Yiddish as well as in English, then they might well find public opinion, even in England, less well disposed to them. In view of this state of affairs, it cannot be regarded as a fact of minor significance that the Jewish investigators, who must have known all this, virtually concealed it, and that the other investigators brought it forth to general knowledge. Neither is it of minor significance that the Jewish press has absolutely suppressed these facts, even while pretending to give the results of the British mission's investigations. Insulting references have been made to Captain Wright's report in a Jewish publication of the better class, because he made references to certain practices which are common among the Jews in Poland. It may be said, however, that the references made by Captain Wright are in great restraint compared with the number given in the recent book by author Goodhart. Whether Mr. Goodhart is a Jew or not, the present writer cannot now say. He's a fellow of Corpus Christi College, Cambridge. He is lately Captain, United States Army. He was transferred from the Army at the suggestion of Mr. Morgenthau to act as counsel for the mission, and he says on page 161, "After dinner, Mr. Morgenthau attended a meeting of the B'nai B'rith Lodge, the only chapter of this Jewish organization in Poland. No branches had been permitted in Russia before the war, as it was a secret society and therefore illegal in the Tsar's empire. Major Otto and I, not being members, walked around the town. Mr. Goodhart, as counsel of the American mission, makes an excellent witness as to the kind of people who are coming in large numbers to this country. But their sense of their own political importance and power is the principal point for Americans to consider. The peace conference did not tend to bring unity in Poland. It rather established the disunity for as long a period as the Treaty of Versailles remains to rule the world. The reader has just seen Captain Wright's description of what the Jews demanded. Let the reader now understand what the peace conference decreed. Poland is prohibited from having an election on Saturday. Poland is prohibited from having a registration on Saturday. The Jewish Sabbath is established by law, and government and courts must govern themselves accordingly. Do what you like on Sunday. Order elections on Sunday, as the polls sometimes do. But not on Saturday. It's the Jews' Sabbath on Saturday. Article 11. Jews shall not be compelled to perform any act which constitutes a violation of their Sabbath, nor shall they be placed under any disability by reason of their refusal to attend courts of law or to perform any legal business on their Sabbath. Poland declares her intention to refrain from ordering or permitting elections, whether general or local, to be held on a Saturday. Nor will registration for electoral or other purposes be compelled to be performed on a Saturday. What the Bolsheviks did in Russia, the peace conference did in Poland. It established the Jewish Sabbath. The people who saw this strange setting up of Jewish customs as a part of the law of the land, one of the authorities for such action being the President of the United States, are now flocking to the United States in large numbers. Is it unreasonable for them to believe that if the President of the U.S. could bind Poland to Jewish custom, it is all right to bind the United States too? Moreover, the Jewish separate schools were established by law in Poland. Poland's great trouble has resulted from her lack of schools in which all the population could imbibe Polish ideals expressed in the Polish language. The peace conference authorizes the continuance of that source of trouble. In Article 11, the Jews were mentioned. In Article 9, the term used is Polish nationals. The reader will save himself a great deal of misunderstanding in the perusal of European news if he will translate the clause racial, religious, and linguistic minorities to mean simply Jews. They are the minority that is at the bottom of most of the difficulty, and they are the minority that is the most heard of. It was this minority that dominated the peace conference. Article 9. Poland will provide in the educational system in towns and districts in which a considerable portion of Polish nationals other than Polish speech are residents, adequate facilities for ensuring that in the primary schools instruction shall be given to the children of such Polish nationals through the medium of their own language. In towns and districts where there is a considerable proportion of Polish nationals belonging to racial, linguistic, or religious minorities, these minorities shall be assured an equitable share in the enjoyment and application of the sums which may be provided out of public funds under the state, municipal, or other budgets for education, religious, or charitable purposes. But even that is not all. The Polish state is to hand over the money, but the Jews will distribute it. Educational committees appointed locally by the Jewish communities of Poland will, subject to the general control of the state, provide for the distribution of the proportional share of the funds allocated to Jewish schools in accordance with Article 9. It's most amazing how racial minorities, quote-unquote, are dropped the moment the money comes into view and the definite term Jew is substituted. More than all this, the United States of America, the British Empire, France, Italy, and Japan, the principal allied and associated powers on the one hand, and Poland on the other hand, together make all of these special privileges not a national agreement on the part of hard-pressed Poland, but an international demand on the part of the League of the Nations. Article 12 stipulates that all the agreements affecting racial, linguistic, and religious minorities, which is mere diplomatic camouflage for Jews, should be placed under the guarantee of the League of Nations. This lifts the Jews in Poland completely out of Polish obligation. All they will have to do is complain to the League of Nations, and international Jewry will do the rest. I guess I should point out here, the League of the Nations is another Jewish construct, kind of like the United Nations. It was something they set up, I'm pretty sure, after World War I, and it was a move to kind of get all the Goyim nations to join one League of Nations, right? That's so high and held in high esteem that the Jews can control, particularly the Rothschilds and the Schiffs, Warburgs, Lazard Ferrer, all these Jewish European bankers out of Europe, most notably Rothschilds, like I mentioned. Continuing on, the United States was a party toward the writing of these stipulations into the treaty. The American people are not yet a party to their enforcement. There are a quarter of a million of these Jews coming to the United States from Poland. You have read their demands in Poland. You have read their achievements in the peace conference. Do you say, as an American citizen, that you're ready to take for the United States the dose of Jewish medicine which the peace conference gave to Poland? Do you say, in view of what has been said about the whole situation, that the Jews are showing anything besides a wicked and gloating spirit of revenge in the way they have propagandized against Poland after humiliating her in the peace conference? There you go, that's the end of part two. That was published in the Dearborn Independent, of course, November 6, 1920. Well, that was interesting when you say, I don't really know that much about Poland, especially after World War I. I think most of the listeners, you guys probably know about what Germany went through as a result of the Jews at the Paris Peace Conference and the heavy burdens that they placed on Germany, slicing off pieces of Germany and giving them to France or creating other countries, like Czechoslovakia, and placing a horrible burden of war debt, war reparations, upon the German people, which their treasury at the time decided, you know what, we'll just hyperinflate our way out of the debt and pay it off that way. I really didn't know much about Poland, but Poland, like anywhere else, you let Jews in and you be nice to them and you show your Christian ways and use your Christian heart to take care of these strangers, and they'll eventually stab you in the back and open the gates of the empire and let the barbarians in, the Bolsheviks in, and this is just what Jews do. You show them any kindness, any niceties, any Christian charitable givings, and they just spit in your face and ruin your way of life in your country. That's the way it is, and I guess Poland is no exception here. Just as a side note here before we end it, I read a book on my own program at tedmidward.info, Behind Communism by Frank L. Britton, and it was a really interesting read, and I think if you're interested to know more about Bolshevism and the Jews, and how the Jews infiltrated the American government, the State Department in particular, post-1945, post-World War II, and gave the Soviets, the Bolsheviks, atomic secrets, and how they infiltrated Hollywood, and how they're pretty much everywhere. Go back and read that, or listen to it, on my site. It's quite interesting. Also, if you want to watch a movie about the Bolshevik Revolution, check out The Czechist. It should be on YouTube, and there should be appropriate subtitles and versions with English subtitles. That would be The Czechist, Czechist. I would take that and I would spread it around and post it all over the internet so that people can see what Jewish Bolshevism is all about. I would especially spread it to all the kind of white Republican backwoods hunters, rural blue-collar types. I think they need to see it too. Okay, that's all I have to say about this one. I'm sure we're over time here, going at 1 hour and 10 minutes. I hope you guys have enjoyed. And if I don't see you guys before Christmas, Merry Christmas to you all. Praise Yahweh, praise Christ. Until next time, guys, take care. Bye-bye.
Radio Ariad.